Welcome to Radio Gorgeous, women's voices on culture, style, society and well-being. Radio Gorgeous, where women do the talking.
Sibley's Jewelry.
Yes.
From Brooklyn.
From Brooklyn.
Hometown. Yay.
Yeah.
And you are in London at the Bush Theatre, where your play, and I'm going to say the whole thing.
Oh, congratulations.
We are proud to present a presentation about the Herero of Namibia, formerly known as Southwest Africa, from the German Südwestafrika between the years 1884 1915.
Perfect. I think that you should get. I have to make a medal or something right now. That was perfect.
I'm gonna put my what that title says to me is the incredible difficulty we have in assimilating our pasts and history and atrocity.
Yeah, that's exactly right, I think.
Okay, tell us about the play.
The play sort of follows six actors, three white, three black, as they try to create an ensemble devised theater piece about the first genocide of the 20th century, which was committed by Germany in the south of Africa before World War I. And as they're trying to put together this theater piece, they end up sort of running into contemporary racial politics sticky stuff.
Political correctness.
Exactly.
And what we're allowed to talk about and how we're allowed to talk about it.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. All of that and stereotype and who's offended by it and who's not offended by it and trying to work with other people and misunderstanding and it's a little bit of a knot. And so that hopefully explains, I mean, your understanding of the reasoning for the title makes me feel so happy.
Oh, good.
It really does.
Well, I'm very interested in the idea of stereotype because there's a positive use of stereotype.
Of course.
And, you know, obviously very negative use of stereotype.
Yeah.
But it does help us. It is like a shorthand notation when we say something. It's used in the news all the time for us to assimilate information. But it doesn't mean that that is true.
Right.
And when it's the incorrect application of stereotype, which is where we get into trouble, I think.
I think that sounds exactly right. Because you sort of have, you can't go through your life deeply understanding the inner soul of every single person, like the person that serves you coffee. Like, I mean, although that person, I'm sure, like has like, you sort of, you have to put people into boxes in order to get through life and You can't have that deep connection to every single individual, but then it becomes so troubling when you only see that sort of external thing
as being
true for everyone that matches that what you're qualifying as that external thing, and so that's when it becomes complicated.
Yes. And especially when you're dealing with, I love that. Well, I don't love genocide, but
it's a tricky thing. It's tricky to talk about genocide. This play. I'm like, it's so great. And then it's like, oh no.
You got to see it. Fantastic. Okay, so tell me about this atrocity that they are trying to talk about themselves.
Yeah, it was a genocide that happened that I hadn't realized had happened at all before.
I had not heard about it.
Yeah.
I mean, it doesn't surprise me, unfortunately, but I hadn't heard about it.
Exactly. Yeah. And isn't that sort of surprising since there's so much that we learn about sort of colonialism and there's so much that we learn about sort of dark aspects to German history, let's just say it that way, that there's this thing that sort of spans both. But Germany had a colony for a few years in present-day Namibia, and over the course of trying to colonize, There were two tribes in particular that they set about systematically exterminating. There's a general named Von Trotha, who actually came from China, where there was also was involved in the Boxer Rebellion, which is sort of crazy. And
interesting.
Which it's like, it seems like there's this like line of sort of genocidal, like a genocidal lineage or something like that. But he went to the south of Africa and issued an extermination order to quell the rebellion of these tribes who had been sort of pressed into servitude, more or less, and were rebelling, and so sort of use them as an example for other tribes in the area. So at the end of that military campaign, about 80% of the Herero people were no longer alive. Most of the information that we know about it comes from a pamphlet, a blue book, put out by the British government during World War I.
They were fighting in the Germans in Africa as well.
Exactly.
So was it to educate the troops or sort of propaganda?
It was propaganda, exactly. So it was sort of for people back home to be like, look at these dirty Germans.
This is why we're fighting them here.
Yeah. And so it's not actually the most factual document, but it's sort of one of the only documents that exists that is documenting the atrocities there. And so it becomes this very, again, tricky thing of knowing that for the actors and for myself when I was writing the play, of being so horrified by this event and wanting to learn more about it, but knowing that all the things that I'm learning about it are through such a specific lens.
Mm-hmm. Tainted source material.
Exactly.
Yeah. Interesting. And what? How did you hear about this particular... Like, what drew you to... You know, was it finding out about the atrocity that sparked the play, or was it the other way around, or was it more symbiotic than that?
Yeah, that's a good question. I had been trying to write a different play, but I still haven't written, actually.
You're very sidetracked.
Exactly. It like basically just like went down like an internet wormhole. Literally, because where it's like I was trying to write a play about this actor who is in a lot of Fassbender's movies, and he's a black guy, he's this black dude, and but he's the son of an American GI and a German woman, and he in these movies he always plays an American GI, and I thought that was so weird, and it's like he's black but he's German and he's playing his father sort of in all these movies, and like, ooh, this seems very theatrical.
Fun identity.
Identity politics sort of thing.
Yeah.
And so then I was like, I wonder how many black people there are in Germany. And so I just like Googled black people Germany. And then there was all of this stuff about this genocide that had happened that I had literally no understanding of before. And ended up doing a bunch of research about it and getting sort of more and more interested in it. And then and being a playwright, tried to write a play sort of directly about it, actually when I was in graduate school for playwriting, and therefore having a deadline to write a play also, which is very important. And deadline came up, I had written this play, and it was just really terrible. Like, it was just like maudlin and...
Didn't work.
It just didn't work at all. And so
forced.
Exactly, and just... it just felt stereotyped and inauthentic and all
so
of this
you
stuff.
You fell into that the same trap.
Exactly. Yeah. Once I stopped crying about how bad the play was.
Now you're going to fail.
Exactly. I'm never going to get my degree. I won't ever be a real playwright. I as artists do, try to use that fear and that pain to write a play where actors sort of fail in theatrically overblown but similar ways to the ways that I felt as though I failed in trying to write that first play, and so realized that maybe it's not within my abilities to like write a play directly about this event, but it is something that I feel more equipped to do, to write a play about people failing at creating a piece about that event and like why they would fail and what that says about our society, trying to understand other people and stuff.
Yeah. Can I, I'm going to wade in there and I may make mistakes.
Please.
But as we present to the world, you look to me like a mixed raced woman.
Yeah.
And are you, and am I allowed to ask you that?
That's the trouble with these conversations.
Yeah,
you're like, it's hard. You're always going to offend somebody.
Yeah, exactly.
And you're like, oh no. that's a good question, actually. I am complicatedly not, but also complicatedly so. Both of my parents are Jamaican, born in Jamaica, raised in Jamaica. I was born in the States, in the U.S., and both of them are mixed-race people. So I'm 100% Jamaican, and what that means is blah, 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 blah.
Exactly.
I think.
Yeah. Yes, exactly. Yeah. Yeah, well, I'm adopted. You know, the first thing I found out that about my birth mother, I was like, she was Swiss.
Whoa.
And I was like, Swiss?
That's
like,
crazy. Swiss?
Because I'm on time? You know, like, I'm not Swiss.
Do you like chocolate?
Like, I am not Swiss. But then, the other thing about it, then I found out about my birth father.
Yeah.
And he's either Scottish or Irish and Catholic.
Huh.
And so being raised in New York as sort of a white middle class Jew,
yeah,
it's a very different identity than like, I'm half Catholic? Okay.
Right.
Well, it explains why the first thing I felt about my birth mother was guilt, you know. So I had it coming down both ways. You know? Because the mother was Swiss and Jewish. So
okay.
Was, yeah.
So there.
So yeah, so and I just find that, you know, then you find out something.
Yeah.
And your identity is not your identity.
That's so
bizarre. Or it is.
That's
also
or
it means something to someone else. Yes,
yeah.
It will be. You'll be called.
Okay.
So
that's so fat. How did you find that? Did you do one of those DNA tests?
No.
Or?
No, that one. My son, after my adoptive mother passed away, my son asked me, do you have a picture of your other mother who couldn't keep you?
Oh, yeah.
And so I said, no, should we look? And we found her, and we're in touch with her. And so.
And she's still alive.
Yeah.
That's wonderful.
And she's in Florida.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah.
Okay.
So we go to Hollywood, Florida.
Oh, that sounds very Floridian.
Yeah. It's hysterical. And he has another grandmother.
That's fantastic.
Which is awesome.
That's totally awesome.
Yeah. Yeah. And she and I have a really funny relationship. It's getting close, but it's
yeah.
not mother-daughter.
Well, because you
met
her as an adult,
yeah.
which is such a different...
Yeah.
Well, maybe that also means that you have like less baggage because you didn't have to like
mm-hmm.
be a teenager with her.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't have to apologize constantly.
Exactly.
Like I did with my mother.
Right.
Station, I'm sorry.
I know, I did that. I'm sorry, I stayed at... I didn't mean to... I'm very
I didn't mean angry. To lie to you.
Sorry.
Radio Gorgeous supports women... Women support Radio Gorgeous.
Your play was put in the States.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me about its journey, because it came here on the Simon Gray Award.
Yes, which is very exciting.
Very exciting. Is Simon Gray, as a playwright, is that an evocative name to you? Because here, it's very evocative. I mean, he's one of the biggies.
Yeah, I mean, to me, to be honest, it was something where it's like his name's... actually induced a sense of guilt because I was like, his name sounds familiar.
I should know.
I should be like, oh, that one.
Thank you.
So I was like very excited, but I had to do a little
research.
Yeah, and I don't know why he's slightly less popular in the States than like Harold Pinter is, who's like
it's like his best friend.
Yeah, and so it doesn't totally make sense, but
yeah, his plays hadn't crossed the pond in the way the Pinters had.
But this play was one that I. Well, the first version of it I wrote when I was in graduate school at Brown in Rhode Island.
Mm-hmm.
And then it sort of got picked up by a theater in Chicago where I did a lot of changes and sort of put it together. And so that was its first professional production was in Chicago. And then from there, it went to New York to a theater called Soho Rep. And I worked with the same director that I'd worked with at Victory Gardens in Chicago, a guy named Eric Ting. And he sort of honed it even more for the New York production.
Mm-hmm. And who are you working with here at the Bush Theater?
Oh, I'm working with a director named Bolahan, who's fantastic, and who, like, who'd read the play, and I still don't totally understand how he got it. Or, like, who sent
Why?
It to him.
Why?
I get it. I'm like, somehow he read it, was excited about it, and excited about sort of translating it like from English into English.
Yes.
And
but it's a different cultural experience here. Yes.
Yeah, exactly. And like thought that the play would stand up to that kind of stretching. And so he and I have been in conversation about it for over a year, maybe closer to 2 years at this point. And he was able to sort of connect with the people at the Bush who had also read the play and were excited mm-hmm. about it and excited about him. And so it all sort of magically came together in a way that I'm very thankful for and don't completely understand.
It's alchemical.
Exactly.
Leave it at that. Yes.
There's perfect.
A little bit of magic there.
Exactly. It's like,
I'm not going to mess with it.
I just don't want, I don't want to poke it too hard. I'm just like, very excited that it's working.
Might pop. Just leave that bubble there.
Yeah.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
Fantastic. And what is it like? How did the play change from you're sitting in your, you know, saying, oh my God, this is the whole play. this sucks.
Yeah.
How does it change when there are actual people doing it up on stage? And what's that process like for you?
Completely gratifying and totally different. Like the first cast that I was working with in graduate school, and this director, Michael Perlman, who it works both ways. Like, I think that writers and directors often talk about, I created this beautiful thing and this actor just ruined it. Like, you're like, you know, like, there's like, there's like that stories out there a lot.
Yeah. I mean, it's like directors and playwrights are like, theater is great except for the actors.
Exactly. I had this whole moment and then they like forgot their line and it's like, those actors. But then like, it totally goes the other way too, where it's like, ugh, this writing is terrible and I don't know what's wrong with it. And somehow nothing seems wrong with it in your mouth, 'cause you make it, you like fill it with this this lived experience that I had not even thought of. And so it's so gratifying to like, to get to, I write with like grand concepts and trying to create interesting layered experiences, but then, so like that's sort of like the macro level, but then it's so exciting to get to write for actors on a micro level of seeing like, your comic timing is fantastic and like I can give you so much more to play with, or like you seem so good at sort of connecting in this like gut level to this, and so I want to give you more moments that really like
showcase
and sort of doing and letting the characters in the play, they're written to be incredibly open. The only requirements for casting are that there are 2 women, 4 men, 3 black people, 3 white people,
anybody can show up.
Yeah, exactly. Like, as long, like, it's like, it's not like you have to have straight hair and be like 5'3". Like, if there's like no, there's nothing like that.
There's no blondes. There's no,
exactly. There's, and it's like, there's no like pretty one necessarily, or like all this other stuff. But the sort of specific journeys that the characters go through is something that is able to be honed by working with these different casts and sort of like figuring out the individual perspectives of the characters through the eyes of the performers, which is like, so it's like, I feel like the play doesn't actually exist until I get to work with actors.
Yeah, it's a wonderfully collaborative,
absolutely,
experience for all of you. That must be very gratifying as an actor as well, because you said that sometimes they're like, don't change anything, and don't, you know, don't, your input is, you're not the important person here.
Exactly.
You know, so that must be very refreshing and freeing and wonderful experience for your actors as
I
well.
I hope so. I'm sure it also feels sort of like, do I have to do everything? Like, come on.
I thought you were something? The writer. Could you write?
Could you write? Give me a stage direction? Tell me what I'm supposed to do?
Something? Like, something? Anything?
Just do something different.
Do what you feel.
Exactly. And they're like, oh. But hopefully it feels collaborative and people feel like, because it seems like if you're being asked to perform something night after night, you have to be able to invest. Or like, if you're, otherwise you just feel
attached to it.
Yeah. Like, you're not like an automaton or something who just like spits out lines, does the same thing over and over. You have to like be invested for an audience to care about what you're saying. Mm-hmm. So it seems like also like being open to that collaboration is a good way to allow an actor to feel like an invested artist.
Is that how you always write? Are all of your plays written with that sort of ethos?
I think so. I hope so.
You'll
see. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, because it's like, I strongly believe in the artistry of acting, and so I try to write plays that are fun to, hopefully fun to watch and hopefully fun to do, because otherwise should like really be going to medical school and like saving lives or something instead of doing theater.
And what drew you to theater? As opposed to medical school.
Right, I know. Well, I'm not really good at science. That's one thing.
They don't need me.
They don't need me. It'd be like a massive scourge.
Thanks, but no thanks.
Just like, take the scalpel away from her. I acted as a kid, or like was in plays and stuff at school. And I guess was just sort of drawn to it that way. I think that most people that work in theater are like enter it through acting also. Mm-hmm. It's like there's not very many people that start having their plays produced when they're like 5, you know,
like 6. There should be.
I mean, there's some plays that are written by little kids that are completely amazing.
Mm-hmm. And what? I mean, I think it's obvious through everything that you've said what you feel the relevance of live theater is. But if you could put that into words,
yes, I can try.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I think, Or like, I think that it's like it's becoming increasingly more relevant, as it seems like it should be becoming less relevant, just because it's like you can watch a movie or a television show literally all the time. Like, you can like watch it on your phone as you're walking down the street, and so it's like we have stories everywhere, but we don't have like human interaction everywhere. It seems like that's something that happens mm-hmm. less and less, and so and maybe makes us like less and less able to empathize and like have that kind of that muscle that you need to be able to like interact with other human beings in any sort of effective or affecting way.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so I think that that's like a experience that live theater is sort of the only art form that really, I mean, I know performance art can too, but there's something about being confronted with a real flesh and blood person and being asked to sort of follow their path through something
mm-hmm.
is such a like foundational human thing. And so
that just put me in mind of the original purpose of theater, of Greek mm-hmm. theater,
yeah.
which was to have these plays that everyone
yeah.
watched
yeah.
and learned from.
Yeah.
But yeah, that, but that, that very fundamental
yeah.
one we connected, we, if you can see a human being in this situation, you can see a human being in the situation.
Exactly. Exactly. So well put. Exactly.
Yeah, with the poetics, with yeah. the, you know, you have to have a fatal flaw and a tragedy and a thing. Yeah, whatever.
All that stuff. Yeah. Even more so, it's just sort of like you practicing your humanity.
And yeah.
like, it seems like such a key, or such a way to like have our lives be better.
Yeah.
And like to be better people. That I think it's really important to not lose that.
Yes. Being able to feel, and also because they, without a screen through us, I just on Valentine's Day mm-hmm. went to the new theater at the Globe, which is the indoor Sam Wanamaker Theater.
Okay.
And it's an incredibly intimate theater, and it's only lit by candlelight.
Oh, that sounds amazing.
And you're so close to the actors.
Yeah.
And yet there are Jacobean plays that they're putting on, so they're really quite formal, you know, plays and things. But yeah. it is such an intense experience because of that.
And it must be just so neat also to be in that, in such close proximity to the other audience members too, and
yes.
like feeling people watch the play, and like feeling when like you're all sort of interested in it, and when like someone's having a different reaction than you, and
mm-hmm.
like it's sort of like you're like at like a dinner party with a bunch of people.
Yeah,
or it seems
absolutely
so neat.
Yes,
that sounds awesome.
Yeah,
what play did you see though?
We saw, it was Valentine's Day. We saw The Duchess of Malfi.
Oh, whoa,
everybody
okay.
dies.
Like, this is
so
romantic.
At the end, happy Valentine's Day, honey.
Chocolate.
One gory death after the other.
That's
children and
says,
babies included.
Right,
know?
Which
yeah.
is really the
yeah,
art
that's,
of just like
Valentine's.
Seduction.
Yeah, exactly. Jackie, you've been so wonderful. Thank you for being on Radio Gorgeous.
Thank you so much. It's been so lovely to talk with you.
Yeah, same here. And good luck with the show.
Thank you.
What is next for you?
I am actually from London, moving to a remote area of Morocco for 6 months.
Wow.
Which is great. With my husband, actually. We're both doing research there for different reasons, but we're going to an area sort of south of Marrakesh called Western Sahara. And
okay.
I'm going to hopefully write a play about women there. Which we'll see how that goes.
Wonderful. Good luck.
Thank you so much.
This has been a Radio Gorgeous production for RadioGorgeous.com. Get in contact with us. Contact us on info@RadioGorgeous.com. And to sign up for our shows to come once a week into your inbox. Who can think of anything better, darling?